I guess we have just about everybody here. Dr. Charles Meyer may possibly be joining us a little later. We would like to keep the session as short as possible to around 30 minutes if we could, to give everyone time to get out to lunch and back for this afternoon session. Let me introduce these gentlemen to you. To my left is Dr. Norman J. Hubbard of the Manned Spacecraft Center. Next to him is Dr. Neil L. Nickel of the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, Dr. Robert L. Fleischer of the General Electric Company of in Schenectady, and Dr. Buford Price of the University of California at Berkeley. If each of you gentlemen could give us a brief summation of your own paper or the highlights of the session you participated in, and then we'll open it up to questions. You could begin, yes. Dr. Hubbard.
Well, of course, the thing that I have been partly responsible for is the name CREEP, which has permeated this whole meeting here. Sort of start back with actually last year's meeting. Many people came to the meeting with the knowledge that one could not explain easily the chemical composition of the Apollo 11 soil by mixing the common igneous rocks. In Apollo 12, it's an even more glaring impossibility. Well, after Apollo 11, there arose many names: krypton component, magic component, hidden component, foreign component, exotic component, what have you. What we feel that we've added of considerable significance is material which takes care of all the problems. We've called it CREEP. So, in fact, for Apollo 12, there is no need to talk of a important but unknown component. The origin of this material is open to considerable discussion right now. We've been taking the line of trying to substantiate what its chemical composition are, if there does seem to be a range of materials, not one carefully narrowly defined material, but a class of presently of unknown broadness. This class of materials has a few very distinct characteristics. One, it is an orthopyroxene containing mineral assemblage, which is something new. It has very high concentrations of trace elements and of elements in parts per million concentration. It has high concentrations of things like potassium and phosphorus, which partly make up the name of it. There are three salient things left for us to learn about. Some may not be settled for quite some time, and one's the extent of this material. On what portion of the moon does it cover? We postulate that it comes from the highlands. Are all the highlands of this material? This is presently unknown, but what we would kind of like to think. The age of this material, is it, as we now think, and as some of it has to be, greater than 4 billion years? I mean, some of this material is in the famous sample 13 from Apollo 12, which has a well-substantiated age of 4 billion years. So you have to have the stuff around it before 4 billion years. Do we have any of it forming after 4 billion years? We don't know. If so, the kind of moon one has to have, if you can produce this material at, say, 2 billion years or 1 billion years back from the present, can be quite drastically different from the kind of moon you would have to have if you produced this in one event, maybe in the initial early forming of the highlands, maybe 4.5, 4.4, 4.6 billion years ago. So it has, if it is a widespread abundant material, the age of it can be of considerable significance. We have attempted to get an age on at least one piece of this material. We attempted it by the standard, sort of, in effect, old-fashioned potassium argon. The number coming out is very soft. It is by no means a firm age, but it does it is somewhat interesting. We point out that there are two or three ways this number could be just an accident, but the number coming out is 1.4 billion years. The exposure age, that is the time that this thing has been near enough the surface to be exposed to cosmic radiation, may be as much as 170 million years. We would like to get this kind of information. This is the first preliminary and subject to reanalysis, subject to more careful analysis, subject to the fact the sample we used is not ideal for any of these measurements. It just gives us a tentative first look at what various sorts of ages might be for this. We would like to know this sort of thing. When was glass formed that has this composition? When were the igneous rocks formed from which have seemingly been subsequent later melted to form the glass? How long has this stuff been near the surface? How many times has it been moved around? You'd like to kind of trace it back both in time and in geography and ultimately in chemistry also. I think that essentially wraps up the salient points.
Dr. Nickel?
The Surveyor 3 return material analysis program has been going on now for almost exactly a year. The program is divided into two general categories, those involved with evaluating the engineering aspects of the return material and those involving the science aspects. The engineering aspects are essentially complete. These were conducted primarily by a contractor, the Hughes Aircraft Company, in which they have recently completed their obligations. The science part of the investigations were conducted by individual scientists all over the country, a few in Europe. These are still ongoing. The papers that we heard today, of which there were 16, represents the early results of these investigations. The material was not distributed to them until June, and they are still being distributed at this present time. There is some material that hasn't been distributed at all yet. It is planned to publish the results, the complete results of this, what is defined as a first generation set of investigations in the spring of this year as a NASA special publication. The amount of material used in this first set of investigations amounts to no more than approximately half of the material for those analyses that have some effect upon the material, either total destruction or affects it in any small way. The non-destructive analyses, those that involve optical microscopy and the like, were done on everything, or will be done on everything. The intent being that if we have missed something along the way, we have plenty of material to work with, provided someone has some good ideas of what to do later.
Okay. Dr. Fleischer was co-chairman with Dr. Nickel in the session on Surveyor. Dr. Fleischer, if you could...
I'd like to make a couple of comments about the lessons that we, I think, got out of this session. One is a sort of a personal one, and Dr. Price and I and Dr. Walker, all of whom have been working on a tiny fragment of glass that comes from the optical filter that goes in front of the television camera. And the lesson here is that a very tiny bit of material that you know something about can be of very great scientific power and usefulness. I won't try to describe all the things that have come out of this. Part of this Dr. Price ought to talk about. But what this piece of glass has done is to record cosmic rays, primarily cosmic rays from the sun. And that helps us learn about the cosmic rays themselves and things that cause them. And what I'd like to emphasize is what it's helping us to learn about the moon. Because we can measure how many cosmic rays we have at each depth in this material that we know something about, which we know has not been eroded over long periods of time on the moon, we can use it as a yardstick to compare with lunar rocks, which have been subjected to pummeling by various objects and radiation over very long periods of time. And what we see is there's a difference in the way in which tracks are distributed. and it's due to the fact that the lunar rocks have been eroding. And from these differences, we can get a measure of erosion rates. And we can conclude on this that on a fine scale, that material on the moon is being milled away at about one atom layer each year, a very slow rate indeed. This is occasionally altered by micrometeorites and larger chunks of matter running into rocks, but there is, in back of it all, this apparently rather steady, continuous sort of milling away of material. Sort of a general comment I might make on this session is that this material brought back to Earth from the moon has somewhat brought us back to Earth and put things in a little better perspective. Through the conference, we've been talking about the moving around of things on the moon, the constant attack from these meteorites, and rocks that have been moved up from great depths and turned over and moved around and splattered with hot glass, and of the churning of the soil. Well, what we've learned here has put us back in the realization that this is not a very rapid sort of process that's going on. It's the moon is really a very quiet sort of place, as evidenced by the number of papers at this session that looked involved studies where people looked very carefully for micrometeorite impacts on any of the parts of the Surveyor spacecraft. And there was really no clear evidence of any micrometeorite impact. The single most exciting event on a macroscopic scale that had occurred at the Surveyor site was the later arrival of the Apollo 12 spacecraft, which splattered in.
Dr. Price?
Well, I think it was clear from the session that three different groups from three different institutions all made perfectly competent observations of the kind that Dr. Fleischer's just mentioned, and yet all drew rather different conclusions. This one atom layer per year that Dr. Fleischer mentioned is, of course, an average between the two extreme opinions represented by two of the three groups. One extreme opinion would say that all of the lunar soil could be accounted for by micrometeorite bombardment, that you can make 5 meters of soil in the lifetime of the moon. The other extreme is that you're only contributing perhaps a few tens of centimeters to the lunar soil. At that very conservative extreme, which happens to be represented by both of us, I believe, I think it is possible, and I believe Tommy Gold, whom you all know, would in this rare case side with us, in saying that micrometeorite cratering is not the most important way in which the shapes of rocks are determined, but a much more microscopic process. One of these processes is just the impingement of the solar wind, which removes atom by atom layers from the surfaces of rocks, and this would contribute an erosion rate perhaps of a quarter of an angstrom per year, a tenth of an atom layer. A more violent process, but still not as violent as cratering, is the result of these solar flares that are contributing the tracks that we see in the glass. What happens here, we think, is that over a period of perhaps 100,000 years, the sun spews out so many very heavy nuclei, iron nuclei, that it fills up a crystal with atomically damaged regions to the point where the crystal cannot survive any longer and it breaks off. And this rate may contribute as much as another quarter, half an angstrom per year. And then the third process is the cratering one that you've heard about before, the Zapp craters. Well, he has an appointment. The two things I would like to touch on now are the origin of cosmic rays, which I think is one lesson that may come out of this, which I talked about extensively, and the other is the strange origin of the tiniest particles in the moon, the dust. The Surveyor glass results tiny grains, which both Moret and his French collaborators and we at Berkeley called attention to as being full of tracks. I've got a picture here that just can't hold any more tracks than this, or you'd never be able to see them. This is a 1 micron grain. It may be possible that the sun is responsible for all of these tiny tracks. But to be controversial, I have claimed that there is still a component, perhaps the highest track densities of all, can't come from the moon. Perhaps a percent or so, 3% or so, are extralunar grains that have banged into the moon and broken up and have been circling the sun for a very long time collecting their particles. And, of course, this leads to the prediction that if you look in the bottom of the Pacific Ocean and in Antarctic ice and on other planets, you might find these high track density grains too, which is what we're doing. Well, how do we draw inferences about the origin of cosmic rays from looking at a surveyor glass filter? The argument is that we at Berkeley looked at the satellite records, which were capable only of studying protons and alpha particles over this 2.5 year period. And during the 10-day period in which the spacecraft was up, and we compared them with the tracks that we saw in the surveyor glass and in the Apollo window. There is about 100 tracks per square centimeter in the Apollo window. And we found that the sun prefers to emit iron and the heavy elements. It emits far more than one would expect from just looking spectroscopically at its composition. This is true at low energy. It doesn't appear to be true at high energy. And somehow all of this, we believe, this discovery of the preference of the sun for emitting heavy nuclei, we think may hold one of the answers to why the cosmic rays are predominantly heavy nuclei. So we would suggest that if the sun can do it, why not white dwarfs and supernovas and some other more powerful sources that are far beyond the solar system?
Are we ready for questions, Evelyn?
I think this was you. I didn't understand the diagram that you had where you had helium and hydrogen superimposed and iron.
That was tricky. What we did was to look at the spectroscopic data, which says that there is about 2,500 times as much helium as iron in the surface of the sun, and there's about 25,000 times as much hydrogen as iron. And then after... Okay, 2,500 and 25,000. After taking that into account, the first naive prediction you would make is that you ought to see 2,500 times as many alpha particles coming out of the sun as iron. If the solar atmosphere just sort of gets agitated and stuff comes out. And so our main result was that the very lightest elements, the hydrogen and helium, seem to obey the prediction, the proper proportion. But as you go up to the heavy elements, you have this excess. The iron line stood way out above the helium and hydrogen. And the reason they were superimposed was that we had done this division by a factor of 2,500 and 25,000.
Zach? Dr. Nickel, would you summarize just a bit what the gross conclusions of Hughes Aircraft as engineering studies on what happened to Surveyor after three years on the moon?
If I can, this document has been available now for just about a week, and I briefly ran through the conclusions that they came to. In essence, there really isn't anything too interesting about the anomalies that they found in the various malfunctions that existed in the camera. They were very clever in solving a lot of these problems, and I believe you could probably conclude in one sentence that nearly all, and correct me if I'm wrong, Bill, all of the anomalies found were due to pre-flight treatment of the camera. That is, testing of the camera, calibrating of the various components of it, created anomalies in the equipment such that it failed after prolonged exposure on the surface of the moon.
I think maybe I may have misled you. I had reference to
generally what happened to Surveyor after 3 years exposure to the lunar environment?
There's a whole list of things that's happened. One thing that happened was that the shutter was found open on the camera, and this was quite a surprise. The whether it's been determined whether a signal was sent to the spacecraft to open the shutter or not is not clear. I don't think it did. Bill's nodding his head no, shaking his head no.
There was no signal sent to the Surveyor to open the shutter, but the shutter was found open, and it's a very complex interaction of failures attributable to pre-launch testing.
That's one of a whole host of things, but that one is interesting as any.
If I might perhaps answer your question, the conditions found within the camera, for the most part, indicate that that space is a relatively friendly environment for equipment. As Neil pointed out in the meeting, there's a 600-page volume of these results. The results are, for the most part, rather subtle and require the specialist to interpret them in terms of what they mean to future missions.
Are we to conclude from this that we're over-testing on some of our gear and that a little less rigorous treatment on the ground is going to make for a lot better lifetime in space?
In some cases, that's true. On specific parts, they had been over-tested.
Are you able to differentiate in a general way as to what parts one should test extensively and what parts one should leave alone?
I think you can only be specific. You cannot state generally because each part requires a different testing procedure than others.
Have any further questions?
Dr. Grayson, Dr. Fleischer, do I understand then that you regard the primary source of the chipping away of the rocks or the wearing away of the rocks and making the soil on the moon to be the solar wind and the solar flares?
That's the more conservative view. The more liberal view is that, in addition to that, the craters are perhaps three or four or five times as important.
I think it is clear that both of these effects are taking place. In certain rocks, it appears as though the slow milling away is the primary thing. In others, you have that clearly with the chipping away superimposed on it. Now, some of that chipping away may, in fact, have to do with the what's been called attrition, namely the chipping away of little grains from the surface of the rock accidentally during the collection, return, and ultimate delivery to scientific laboratories.
Okay. All the way in the back.
And gentlemen, the Surveyor TV camera is something that most of us rather ignorant earthlings can relate to fairly directly because all of us have seen a camera, all of us have seen a lens and so on. Is there any way you could put in layman's language such that my listeners might understand just what you've discovered about this camera that was on the moon for 2.5 years?
Brought up fairly well today. The fact that we considered this a unique opportunity to evaluate just what the effects of prolonged exposure has been, and the fact that no positively identified pits of micrometeorite origin have been discovered. So this enables one to set a new limit on the flux. This may not, in fact, be a limit, but a new number that represents a limit at the present time on what the flux rate for micrometeorite infall is. The fact that the camera turned out to have survived as well as it did was, I think, amazing. The design criteria for the camera was not to survive a lunar night. That was not one of the design criteria, but they did on a number of the other missions attempt to turn it on, and I think we're successful in two instances. So one could go through and just repeat, in essence, what took place today in the session to get a good idea of just what the effects of this environment has been. And it would take, as I say, going over all of the points to summarize that in any detail.
John?
One specific point, assuming that camera lens was a rather fancy piece of equipment, was there anything unusual by way of particle tracks in it, and were the lens coatings such that they may have affected the particle tracks, if any?
There are a number of optical components to the camera. The lens is, in fact, a zoom lens, so there are many elements involved, and they're all stacked up. And there's the top lens element is the one that received probably more radiation than others. But that was not exposed to radiation directly. There, on top of that was the filter, with which Price and Fleischer have been discussing. Well, I believe Buford Price has now etched all the way down through the bottom of this filter, and he's seen tracks exiting the bottom, so they're not being stopped. All of them are not being stopped. So that means there's a good possibility that they're going right into the top lens element of the zoom lens, which we have not disassembled yet, which no one has really looked at yet in any detail.
There are surely penetrating particles that have gone all the way down through there. You find these same things inside the Apollo spacecraft during a mission, too.
Well, Alexander?
If you've already covered this, forgive me, but I'd like to ask a rather naive question. Is there any difference in the reactions of the different materials that you've tested, the steel, the aluminum, the glass, that you can describe?
Different reactions.
I'm asking, how did they survive, and can you tell anything differently from them?
The Teflon. There were pictures shown today by several of the investigators. The Teflon tends to darken. It becomes brittle. It's believed to outgas and therefore becomes brittle. What it's losing, I'm not aware of. There is radiation damage associated with the paint. The paint on the outside of the camera and all painted surfaces was, in fact, bone white when it left here. And if one was able to remove the fine-grain adhering material on the surface, you would find that it was also discolored by radiation darkening. There is a whole host of different types of materials. And I'm sure you could probably get this information from the engineering report, which Hughes has put out.
By way of following that up, if you had discoloration in the paint after 2.5 years on the moon, how would it compare with similar discoloration if you just left it standing at the yard at Hughes?
Bill, do you have an answer to that? I don't.
Well, if you neglect the Los Angeles environment, the paint would stay white on Earth. It did discolor in space to the degree, slightly more than the degree we would have predicted from laboratory testing. The patterns and the spectral character of the discoloration were identical to what we expected.
Zach, I'm going to come
over. Somewhere in the same general area. If you found no evidence of micrometeorite damage, you did find evidence of radiation damage. Can we conclude from this then that if we ever had a lunar base, that this might be a rather dangerous situation for people to try to live in this environment for a long length of time because of the radiation, as opposed to getting hit in the head with a micrometeorite or a meteorite or whatever?
Well, I don't think you'd want to wander around without something on because you couldn't breathe. And whatever you use to protect yourself to give yourself an atmosphere of oxygen would be enough to shield you fairly well from most of this radiation damage, which was right in the top surface. That's an interesting problem one has to worry about. In fact, this man next to me has a story to tell about helmets.
Yeah, of course, one of the things we've been doing is, this has been a joint endeavor, is to use the Apollo space helmets as particle dosimeters. And we have recorded then the particles that have passed through these helmets and into these helmets over during the space missions. And there you're talking about coming through an inch or so of the equivalent of an inch or so of aluminum, and yet you accumulate particles at an appreciable rate. We're not accustomed to mind reading, but this is a way of learning what has been passing through the astronauts' minds. And at any rate, the story is that over a normal mission, this is no danger at all, but if you start talking about a couple of years' time with that sort of covering, then it is enough that it makes people wonder very considerably as to whether you might be damaging enough irreplaceable cells to be in some sort of trouble.
Dr. Price, I know you said something about the cosmic rays, that some of them might be coming from other sources, but if we just assume that they were all still coming from the sun, from what you know, do you think the sun is behaving itself? I mean, in a sense, you know, with the models that you now have, or do we have a more active sun than we once thought?
No, I didn't mean to say that, let me distinguish between the energetic particles that come from the sun and that can be detected in satellites when you see a bright flare. They are quite distinct from the what we call galactic cosmic rays. They're two different things, and we can study them because the galactic cosmic rays are coming in at all times, even when the sun is very quiet. What I really meant to say is that what we learn about energetic particles close at hand coming from the sun may change our ideas about the ones that are coming from fantastically energetic exploding stars, supernovas, and other very active stars. And I think we should probably open our minds again to the possibility that the answer is more subtle. It isn't just as simple as saying they're coming from supernova explosions alone. Maybe all sorts of other varieties of stars that are active and have high magnetic fields, pulsars, white dwarfs, et cetera, could be contributing.
Okay, let's take one last question from John Lennon.
Is the after having looked at the astronauts' helmets, is the and having heard from my friends Goffman and Tamplin and all their friends who say all radiation is bad, is there sufficient concern about the amount of dosage so that there's any revamp being considered for the astronaut helmets themselves? In other words, a thin layer of lead shielding within or that sort of thing?
No, it would take very considerable shielding thicknesses to do anything significant with these particles, and that gets to be a very expensive sort of procedure. So I haven't any direct contact with the people, radiation biologists whose proper job it is to worry about this sort of thing. But it is nevertheless my impression that for the duration missions that have been flown, that this should not be a real problem. The actual estimates of loss of cells is roughly comparable with the estimates of the just normal attrition of cells, which are thought by many people at least to die off at an appreciable rate throughout the latter half of life, at any rate.
Okay. Thank you.